Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2005. This session, Global Climate Change and the World's Poor, presented in the Fireside Room by Philip Mote, disc number MOP-2005-03. Let's listen in.
Wait, did you ring your bell?
Yes. So today, I mean, this could be the most depressing of the five talks that I'm giving this week. But I'm going to try to end it on a slightly upbeat note. Go ahead and move to the next slide. So in case you haven't been to one of the sessions before, my name is Philip Mote. I'm a research scientist at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I'm also the state climatologist for the state of Washington. I've been studying climate change in one form or another for over 10 years. And I particularly enjoy the opportunity to come to Holden and present not just a scientific perspective, but also to work in at least my view of how faith and morality play a role in thinking about this kind of issue. Today is the third of a series of five talks. The first, on Monday, we started out considering as a sort of background for these global environmental challenges the lessons of stewardship from the Bible and also the success stories of dealing with acid rain and ozone depletion, for examples where scientists identified a problem, policymakers crafted policies to address it, and the public was on board and things happened. Yesterday we talked a little bit about the science of climate change, the background for statements like most of the warming of the last 50 years is attributable to human activities. Today we're talking about the impacts of climate change, and particularly as they relate to the world's poor, which carries with it the some of the gospel themes about concern for the poor. Tomorrow I'm going to mix in a bunch of things, some about the impacts of climate change in the U.S., some about the political shenanigans that are going on around this issue, things that individuals can do to address the problem, and we're going to have a portion of the lecture devoted to a guest lecture by Steve Jones, who is also from Bethany Presbyterian Church in Seattle, and he's an engineer with a wind energy company, and so he's going to talk about wind energy, which is a part of the future for the U.S. energy mix. And then finally, on Friday, we're going to shift gears again and talk about a different type of global environmental problem, species extinction, which I call undoing creation. So let's just pick up where we left off yesterday, and that is projections of future global temperature change. These colored lines each represent different sets of assumptions about how human society will develop over the next 100 years. You can see the dates down here. And they result in different rates of warming. The temperature change is indicated on this axis. So when you consider all of the different uncertainties, the central estimate for warming over this century is 3 degrees Celsius, which is about 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the global average temperature change that's expected. However, the global average temperature does not represent what may happen in a given location, and in fact, the rates of warming are considerably larger over land than over ocean, and they're largest in high latitudes. This is temperature change in degrees Celsius down here, with the reds being very large changes, 8 degrees or more in the Arctic. So that's 15 degrees Fahrenheit, very large changes. Notice that even though generally the tropics warm less than high latitudes, in this particular scenario, the warming over much of South America and Africa is in excess of 3 degrees Celsius or 5 degrees Fahrenheit, 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So even there, the warming is expected to be substantial if we follow this particular scenario. Now, one of the issues of climate change is the notion of commitment. That is, that there are lags in the system, and so any time we decide to stop changing the climate, we've already committed ourselves to some future warming. This is illustrated by a series of experiments. The carbon dioxide quantities observed in the 20th century are shown as black, and then four different scenarios. One, let's just suppose that in the year 2000, we had frozen the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. You know, you'd have to imagine suddenly no coal-fired power plants, no gasoline automobiles, no natural gas furnaces or stoves. So, you know, it's obviously not realistic, but let's just suppose that happened. CO2 was flat throughout the 21st century. That's this yellow experiment. The second experiment says, well, let's suppose that CO2 levels off in the year 2100 at a value that's roughly twice the pre-industrial level, about 550 parts per million. The third is, let's assume that we go to a tripling and then level off. And then the fourth is, let's just keep climbing. So these are the carbon dioxide quantities on this top graph. This is the observed temperature change shown in black, and then the yellow is the if CO2 were stabilized, and you would still get a slight warming of 1 or 2 tenths of a degree Celsius, even though carbon dioxide was already frozen. And when you go out to these higher rates of change, that's also true. So at any stage, when we try to stop the warming, it's sort of coasting. It's a little bit like hitting the brakes on a freight train. You know, you don't stop in 10 feet or 50 feet, it takes a mile. This is particularly true when we look at sea level rise, which is this bottom curve. And you see that even with stabilized carbon dioxide, in the 21st century, the sea level would continue to rise by tens of centimeters. And of course, for a more realistic scenario like this blue one, we would get a warming of you know, 10 or 15 centimeters in this century, and then roughly equal amounts in the next century. We'll come back to this in a moment. Well, if you remember back a few days ago, I said that the international community had agreed on a goal of stabilizing greenhouse gas concentrations at a level that would prevent dangerous interference with the climate system. So there's this question, what level is dangerous? Is it 1 degree Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius or something else? Jim Hansen has suggested that 1 degree Celsius would constitute dangerous because of the amount of sea level rise you would get from that and the damage that it would do to coastal communities. And you can see that it's virtually certain that we'll get at least 1 degree of warming just in the next 50 years. 2 degrees, there's some possibility that we could see only 2 degrees of warming over this century and in fact stabilize at 2 degrees. But that would require a fairly low climate sensitivity, which is possible. But it would also require fairly large changes in the way we get and use energy, which are represented by this green curve. So as we think about this issue, especially in context with the world's poor, this notion of dangerous and a level of dangerous climate change is sort of in the background. Okay, next slide.
I'm sorry.
One issue with climate change actually has nothing to do with climate per se, but straightforwardly with carbon dioxide. And this is something that I'll bet that none of you has ever heard before because it hasn't crept out into the popular media yet. But it turns out that the balance between carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and dissolved carbon dioxide in the ocean is such that as you get more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the ocean acidity increases. And this paper attempted to estimate the amount that the carbon dioxide amount changes of the last and future century indicated in this left curve, how that would affect the acidity of the ocean, the pH, by the scale on the left. And what they estimated was that in the last 50 years, the pH of the ocean has changed by about 0.1 units, which by itself isn't much concern, but it's expected that over this next century, it would change by another roughly 3 pH units. And that's starting to get substantial, and it may well interfere with the life cycle of zooplankton, which form calcium shells that incorporate carbon, and then when they die, their shells sink to the bottom, and that's actually the main way that the planet converts atmospheric CO2 back into rock. It's through the action of these organisms. So there's a real concern now in the scientific community that we're playing with a dangerous part of the climate system just by having high CO2 levels, which may both interfere with the life cycle of these critters and interfere with this long-term storage capability, which would then, of course, feed back into higher CO2 levels. As we start to talk about the differences of how climate change will impact different areas, one key factor is how will the balance between precipitation and evaporation change. That's represented in this graph, which is runoff change from a particular climate model for about 2050. And it does. I'd encourage you to sort of defocus your eyes a little bit, because the details here are really not important. The yellows and reds are places where runoff would decline in this particular scenario, and the blues and greens are places where it would increase. And broadly, you can see that around the fringe of the Arctic, you get very large runoff increases, and that's simply because much more of precipitation would fall in a warmer climate in those places. And a lot more of it would be rain, by the way. Now, in most of the tropics, by contrast, you see a lot of reds and pinks indicating a shift the other direction, that there would be less runoff, partly because of less precipitation, partly because of more evaporation. So water availability could vary quite substantially from place to place. And again, we can't place too much stock on where this particular climate model puts the reds and the blues, but most climate models have roughly the same pattern of less water availability in much of the tropics and more in the high latitudes. That, of course, plays a big role in agriculture. This particular simulation is actually a completely separate issue from water availability. This is assuming no change in water availability. What would the changes in temperature do to cereal yields? The two scenarios here are the B1 scenario, which was the very low end of warming from that diagram a couple of minutes ago, and the A1FI was the very high end of warming. So these are sort of, you can think of as the best case and the worst case scenario for end of century. And as with the runoff, blur your eyes a little bit and don't read too much into the exact color of any one country. But generally, you find that for modest rates of climate change, most of the colors are in this sort of zero, plus or minus 5%, which is very, very small. You know, with some small gains in a lot of northern countries and some small losses in other countries. But for a very high rate of warming, most places, in this simulation, most places would be in the negative category. And you see Africa in particular, of great concern, decreases of 10 to 30% in every country in this crop simulation. That, of course, would be of great concern because of all the problems already in Africa and other developing countries with having adequate food. And then if climate change were pushing things the wrong direction, that would create even more problems. So in a lot of these impacts that we're thinking about, we find that the more northerly countries either don't suffer much impacts or actually have some positive impacts, whereas the tropical countries often end up having negative impacts and of course less capacity to deal with negative impacts.
Wait, so
yeah.
If on the B1, that's a little bit of warming, right?
Yeah.
So why would the US lose stuff if on the A1F?
Yeah, that's one of several puzzles on here, and look also at China, where at the low rate of warming they're worse off, and at the high rate of warming they're better off. I don't know the reasons for those things. It may have to do with precipitation. Also, representing things country by country may not be the best way to simulate this. This is for illustrative purposes only. And you know the shading of any one country really isn't necessarily to be believed, but you know it highlights a concern that Africa could see a reduction in cereal production with a substantial rate of warming. So let's go back to the sea level issue. I already pointed out that there's a very long time lag, and this sort of illustrates why. This is a simple model of global sea level in which carbon dioxide stabilized at a doubling at this point here, this vertical line, 70 years in. And because there is a little bit of additional warming, and also because the glaciers take a while to respond to past climate, the glacial melt contribution to sea level, which is this sort of brown curve here, goes quite a bit beyond the actual warming and you know makes its final contribution a couple hundred years later. So you get about half a meter of sea level rise just by melting the glaciers and the small land ice. So this is not including Greenland and Antarctica, where most of the ice is. The other factor, though, is that the ocean water expands when it's heated, so that's thermal expansion. And the ocean has a very slow circulation where water, cold, salty water, sinks in the North Atlantic, and then it creeps southward, sometimes makes a couple of circuits around Antarctica, wanders into the Pacific, and then sort of floats upward in the Pacific. So the properties of the surface water in the North Atlantic help to determine the properties of the water throughout the world ocean with some lag time. And people have measured, for example, chlorofluorocarbons and been able to show that this pulse of chlorofluorocarbons, a completely unnatural substance, follows this global ocean circulation. But by the same token, that water is now exposed to a warmer climate than it was 100 years ago. So very slowly, the world's ocean water is being exposed to the warmer surface of the North Atlantic, and the whole ocean is very gradually warming up and expanding. And because even with a stable climate, you'd have to cycle all that ocean water through to come to equilibrium with the warmer climate, this ocean expansion term, the green curve here, doesn't even really show much change over 900 years because that new water is still coming to the surface and getting warmed and expanding. So you add those two things together and you can see that the sea level rise, even though you stabilize climate in year 70, sea level rise continues for hundreds of years later. So this is really the gift that keeps on giving for our descendants. And this is not even including Greenland and Antarctica, and it's quite likely that with a couple of degrees of warming that Greenland would eventually entirely melt. And instead of talking about sea level rise of a meter, it would be like 6 or 7 or 8 meters. But again, it would be over this time scale of hundreds of years. So, you know, the human race, the mind is just not geared to thinking about problems that will go on, you know, 900 years from now because of what we do today. So there's just sort of a disconnect of, well, how can we even deal with this? But it helps maybe to sort of illustrate what very large sea level rise would mean for certain places. So let's, yeah.
What's the time scale?
So there's hundreds of years down here. So,
yeah, but like, what does that mean? Where now?
Well, you could imagine that we're partway to a doubling of CO2. This is not a realistic a realistic start to the problem. It's just illustrating the timelines involved. So let's take a look at the next slide, which is how would Florida look if Greenland melted? Again, this is a lot of sea level rise, 7 or 8 meters, but you lose a good quarter of South Florida. And you might imagine that if this happened over the course of centuries, that Floridians would build dikes around the state, sort of the way Holland is diked off. But then, you know, why would you go to Florida if not for the beaches? If the beaches were abandoned behind the dikes, well, I guess you'd go there to eat the oranges out of the orange grove or something. Watch the space shuttle launch from a little island over here at Cape Canaveral. This is not going to happen anytime soon. But let's think about another place, Bangladesh. Go ahead, next slide. Bangladesh lies on the river deltas of two major rivers, and it's subject to flooding both from the rivers themselves and also from storm surges from the Bay of Bengal. And under even modest current conditions, much of the country is sometimes underwater. In 1998, a combination of a high tide, river flooding, and a typhoon meant that something like two-thirds of Bangladesh was underwater. Almost unimaginable, but it's so flat. And so you think about raising sea level a meter or two, and that sort of thing, instead of happening every 10 years, would happen every year. And it would become much more difficult to have agriculture continuing in much of the country. So again, another issue with sea level rise, of course, mm-hmm. is those places that have nowhere to go, and perhaps nowhere is a greater example than the country of Tuvalu, which is a chain of small islands in the Pacific. Funafuti is the island shown here. It's the main island. Highest point is only 4 meters above sea level, so that's 13 feet. Not very much room. And so you can imagine that with a meter of sea level rise, a significant amount of land area would disappear. And in fact, the roughly 10 or 15 centimeters of sea level rise in the 20th century was enough to increase the frequency of events like this, where there was, you know, flooding in some of the settlements in Tuvalu. And, you know, what do you say to a nation like this about global warming? Oops, sorry, we erased your island from the map. They're already making contingency plans of what will they do in 50 years when the island becomes uninhabitable because of sea level rise. Another issue, impacts of climate change concerns human health. And I don't want to paint the picture that everything is negative. There are certainly some positives with climate change. Modest rates of climate change would benefit agriculture in some places. And in the case of human health, there's no question that we would get, and are getting, fewer cold-related deaths. In fact, because the amount of warming in cold places and cold times is a lot bigger than the amount of warming at hot places. So there's some trade-offs there. Asthma is sharply on the rise, and one hypothesis is that it's caused by increased exposure to ozone. And ozone, it turns out, is produced much more rapidly in high temperatures. So when it gets up to 90 degrees or above in the cities, the nitrogen compounds that are emitted by combustion, you know, automobiles, for example, react to form ozone. And that's a link between temperature, ozone, and human health, specifically to the lungs of young children, that's pretty well established. The question is whether that exposure to ozone is what's contributing to asthma. But there's no doubt that there are increased respiratory problems with air quality, some of which are related to temperature. Another issue is what are called vector-borne diseases. These are diseases that are carried by some kind of insect or other moving creature. A familiar example is malaria, which of course is transmitted by what kind of? By mosquitoes, a specific set of species of mosquitoes that transmit that. Other examples are hantavirus, which we had outbreaks of here in the US. West Nile virus, which you probably heard a lot about in the last 5 years. A lot of these vector-borne diseases, the vectors themselves or the microorganism or the virus, depending, might have a different behavior. In the case of malarial mosquitoes, the mosquitoes themselves breed faster in a warmer climate and therefore it can spread the disease much faster. A related issue is water quality. There are a lot of organisms that are very detrimental to humans that reproduce very quickly in warm water. There was an example in Peru in 1998 during the last El Nino event where the elevated temperatures associated with El Nino produced an outbreak of cryptosporidium related to the high water temperature. I guess at low to moderate temperatures, they're very low concentrations of cryptosporidium, and then you get above a certain temperature and it just takes off. So there are a lot of these things that, you know, we already understand how they're connected. This is one that's a bit more speculative, and that is, as plants encounter higher carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it changes the actual chemistry of the plant itself. And there's some concern that the nutritional value of plants might go down because of the imbalance between carbon and rarer nutrients like potassium, for example. This one is speculative. The rest of these are fairly well known to different degrees. These are all areas of concern in a warming climate. So the example of heat-related deaths, just to emphasize that the sufferers of climate change, although disproportionately poor, are not necessarily only in poor countries. This was the heat wave in France in August 2003. And if you know anything about French culture, you know that everybody who can afford to leaves for holiday in the month of August. And a lot of people left right around the 1st of August to go to the beaches or wherever they go for a few weeks. And the people who were left behind, in a lot of cases, were elderly or otherwise unable to cope with the high temperatures. And so what's shown here is for each day in the month of August, the maximum temperature in red with the scale on the right and the minimum temperature in blue. So the high temperatures were in the 90s every day for about 10 days. And the low temperatures were also quite high, around 70 degrees. And this is the number of deaths each day, the excess deaths above what would be expected that time of year. And it totaled about 15,000. The worst day here, the last day of the heat wave, 2,200 people died just from the heat alone. So there's a clearly very tight connection. And what we see in each of these impacts, whether it's human health or water or agriculture or sea level rise, if you're rich enough, you can spend money to protect yourself. You can build a dike to protect from sea level rise. You can buy public health infrastructure to protect against vector-borne diseases and other problems. You can pay money for different agriculture technology, whatever. But the poor, and particularly in the countries where the impacts are greatest, don't have the opportunity or the wealth to reduce their vulnerability. Another example is what happened when Hurricane Mitch struck Central America in 1998. 10,000 deaths and wiped out the economies of two countries. And that kind of hurricane, of course, you know, would have killed some people in the U.S., but we have better warning systems, better structures. So there are very different impacts in the poor countries compared to the rich countries. And this gets us back to some of the things we touched on Monday about the responsibility that humans have to keep the creation in good working order, because its function is to provide sustenance for all the creatures and people on the earth. And if we start tinkering with it in such a way that it can no longer function well, we have to be very concerned. And as we've seen, there are a lot of issues of rich versus poor countries, of people today versus people centuries from now, dealing with the consequences of what we're putting into the atmosphere right now. Next. So go ahead and click about four times for these. I guess it was all in one. Okay, so go back. Sorry. Just click once. So there.
You
click, click once more.
So I click once, twice.
Yeah.
Three.
Three.
Wait. So one, two.
Okay, stop there. Just click twice.
That was just two clicks.
Oh, and then it went on.
Yeah.
And jumped. Okay. Well, forget that. So there are a bunch of downsides of rising CO2. We've already talked about them. It's just
computers don't work as well.
Go to the next one. Yeah. Go to the next one. Yeah. That's all right.
Okay.
Well, what are some the moral dimension, you know, I've already said this, the poor are likely to feel impacts of climate change disproportionately. The beneficiaries of climate change tend to be those in richer countries. They also benefit in the sense that they benefit from the more advanced lifestyle, more consumptive lifestyle that produces more climate change. Now, if we were just doing some kind of economic analysis to say, well, should we change the climate or not? Well, let's do a cost-benefit analysis, the way, say, a company would before deciding whether to build a new plant or expand into a new market. So, you know, they do the cost-benefit analysis, and then if the sum comes up positive, they do it. But we can't really do the same thing with climate change, because it's not a zero-sum game. The winners could win a lot more than the losers, but if the losers lose without being compensated by the winners, then it's really not a fair proposition. It's what you need to find something that economists call Pareto optimal, which means nobody's worse off and some people are better off. And as we've seen, there are a lot of downsides. And if there were a mechanism in place to compensate the losers, then it might be morally acceptable to go ahead and change the climate and just let it happen. But I think, the passage in Matthew where Jesus is saying, when the Son of Man comes, he'll separate the sheep from the goats, and the sheep, the good guys, are the ones who, when I was hungry, you fed me, when I was thirsty, you gave me drink. And even though, in a sense, we can't see Bangladeshis in the year 2200, we know enough about what we are doing that impacts the poor, that I think we still have a moral responsibility to act on our knowledge. So, not to leave you feeling depressed, there are actually a lot of things that can be done already to address the issues of climate change and to prevent them from reaching dangerous levels. A simple and cost-effective one is to capture methane, which is the second leading greenhouse gas. It comes out of landfills and wetlands and other places, and it can be captured and burned. It's natural gas. Local air pollution, as we've seen with ozone, has downsides itself. So the more we address that, you get a double benefit of reducing the greenhouse gases as well. Push for renewable sources of electricity. We'll talk a bit more about that tomorrow. Require more energy efficient buildings and appliances. It turns out that if you invest a certain amount of money in energy efficiency, you will automatically get that money back after a certain length of time. An example is compact fluorescent bulbs, which I see Holden has installed in a lot of places. They cost more up front, but typically in over the life of the bulb, you'll save an equal amount of energy, and then considerably more than if you were replacing those bulbs because they last longer. The case of refrigerators is interesting. About 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the US EPA realized that even though there were very energy efficient refrigerators on the market, hardly anybody was buying them. And the reason was that the people buying refrigerators are not the ones paying the electric bills. 80% of refrigerators are bought either by developers putting in new apartment buildings or new houses. They want to just keep their costs low, so why would they pay $50 more for an efficient refrigerator? Or they're bought by landlords who are not buying the electricity. So the EPA came up with a rule that only the more energy efficient refrigerators could be sold. And some estimates are that this has reduced the electricity consumption associated with refrigeration by something like 25%. Now, people had to pay up front a little more for their fridges or for somebody else's fridges, but the costs were recouped by the economy as a whole. The same kinds of things have been considered for air conditioners, washers, and dryers. It would take a little bit more of a political push for that to happen. Energy efficiency in automobiles is a big issue. We'll talk a lot more about this tomorrow, but after the oil crisis of the early 70s, Congress passed the Corporate Average Fuel Economy, or CAFE standards, which required a certain level of fuel efficiency by vehicles. And since then, those standards have not been changed, even though the technology of engines has allowed a lot more efficiency. What we've tended to do is make bigger engines that are more powerful. But with current technology, we could drastically change the oil consumption of this country by simply requiring more efficient automobiles. It would cost purchasers of automobiles more money, but again, the initial investment would be recouped over the long term, especially if you add in the subsidized cost of oil. Yes?
And is another factor in that truck-based vehicles were accepted, were not included, and therefore Detroit started making SUVs which are truck-based?
Right. The The original CAFE standards distinguish between passenger vehicles and light trucks. The justification being that farmers and small businessmen or artisans often use light trucks as work vehicles, and it would be an unfair burden on them. But yes, SUVs count as light trucks. And so as the market, and you know, yes, Detroit was making more SUVs, but Americans were buying them. But those are subject to much lower fuel efficiency standards, and they're also subject to much weaker emissions regulations. So there's this dual standard, and that's why a lot of people dump on SUVs, because they pollute more, they are less fuel efficient, and then of course there are the safety issues, which is another can of worms entirely. There are also, of course, non-fossil sources of mobile energy. Biodiesel is one that's currently available. Hydrogen fuel cells may become available sometime in the future. We'll talk more about these tomorrow. And then carbon sequestration, that is taking carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it, for example, by planting trees or by installing special carbon dioxide scrubbers in power plants. Now, these are all sort of, you know, grand what the U.S. or the world could be doing. But each of these also has applications on the personal or the family level. And this book, Stormy Weather, which I recommended the bookstore buy, and they did, so that I think there are still some copies over there if you're interested, 101 Solutions to Climate Change. So there are a bunch of illustrated examples of how this could be done on various scales. But let's just take an example. On the renewable sources of electricity, a lot of utilities now have the option to buy more of your electricity from green sources. So you can say, I'm willing to pay a little bit more to have green electricity. Now what that does, if you do that, not only is it supporting the renewables, but it's also sending a message to the utility that this customer cares about environmental issues, and, you know, particularly about switching from coal, for example. Another thing, you know, obviously, if you own your own house, you can retrofit by changing the windows. If they're leaky windows, you can put in double pane or triple pane windows. Buy more of energy efficient appliances. EPA has what they call the Energy Star program, which rates different appliances that, you know, if they're particularly efficient. You know, typically you're spending more money for the item, but then you're saving money in the long run on energy. And then if you're in the market for an automobile, of course, there are some very efficient automobiles out there. Diesel is a good way to go. If you have access to biodiesel, that's probably the best approach to getting around, short of riding a bike, which is what I do. So there are a lot of kind of individual steps that people can take, big and little, to start addressing this problem if you believe, as I do, that we really have to think about the way our lifestyle impacts the rest of the world. So I wanted to leave you on this kind of upbeat note and open it up to questions or further comments. Yes?
There was a tax law, I don't know if it's still in effect, but if a company bought a big SUV, they'd get a better tax write-off.
Yeah.
But then after they bought it, some of these smaller individuals, they wouldn't have bought it if they'd only taken so much gas. They said, oh.
Yeah, there's been a lot of people who have been grumbling about the poor gas mileage of the Hummer, which actually is so big that it does not have to be submitted to the EPA for fuel economy testing. So there are no official EPA estimates for the Hummer, but the informal reports are that it gets around 10 miles to the gallon.
I think that's why.
Yeah. You're quite right. There is, I should mention, there is a tax credit for the hybrid cars. So you can get $2,000 write-off for buying a new hybrid vehicle.
This is national, federal, or
yeah, federal.
And it's just this year until they renew it.
Well, it keeps coming up for renewal and expiring. Because I know it's been in place for several years.
I've been here for several weeks. I have only skimmed the newspapers a little late. But I understand we just passed the transportation and energy bill last week. Mm-hmm. Congress passed the new transportation and energy bill. Do you know anything about these? How you could assess these bills? And
No. I don't. A lot of it hadn't passed when we left, so.
All right. This happened, I think, Saturday or something.
Okay. Yeah, we missed that.
This is millions
of these, unfortunately, every time any kind of energy, bill comes up to Congress, if they're trying to say that they're, pushing for renewables, they always throw in a provision for ethanol. Mm-hmm. And ethanol is great if you're a corn farmer, and it doesn't really make much sense to anybody else, because the amount of energy required to produce a gallon of ethanol is significantly more than a gallon of gasoline. So you're actually better off simply burning gasoline because the combination of the low fuel, the low energy yield of a gallon of ethanol plus the huge amount of energy required to make it means that burning a gallon of ethanol is equivalent to burning about 2 gallons of gasoline. Mm. So you're better off just burning the gasoline. That's not true of biodiesel, which is not a corn-based, but rather an oil-based, vegetable oil-based fuel. And so if you have a diesel car, running biodiesel in it is pretty close to the most carbon neutral thing you can do to get around. Yes?
Well, it's probably an insipid question, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. Are there any charts or any statistics that come out that show the difference between air traffic versus the combination of train and auto?
That is an excellent question. Yes, there are. Roughly the equivalence is if you fly somewhere, it's about the same amount of CO2 as if you drove there alone. How you actually calculate passenger miles depends on things like the load factors and what kind of aircraft that particular airline is flying. So if you really wanted to know, for my VW Jetta versus, Southwest Airlines from Spokane to, whatever, it could be very complicated, but they're roughly of comparable magnitude. Now, you raise an interesting point because, we're often very conscious of how much we're driving because, you go to the gas pump and you see these big numbers that appear, to us they're big numbers because we're not used to 250 a gallon or whatever. And so we're very conscious of how much gasoline we're consuming. But, if I were to fly, say, to visit my parents in the Bay Area, it's roughly 700 air miles each way, that's 1,400 miles. That's the equivalent of burning the same amount of gasoline as if I drove there and back, which is a lot. And I've found that, the people my age who are environmentalists ride their bikes to work, and then they'll take 5 or 6 vacations a year in which they're flying to remote corners of the world. They could skip one of those trips and drive a Hummer to work every day, and they'd still come out. But there's another interesting issue, which is that in the Kyoto Protocol, this international agreement, the nations that are participating, air travel is exempt. So there is no provision to factor in the difference between flying and driving. And there's no incentive for nations to encourage people to take the most carbon efficient mode of transportation, which incidentally is an intercity bus followed by a train. And then the car and the airplane are comparable.
But I was thinking of freight.
For freight, rail is far more efficient than truck.
Yeah, and you go to Los Angeles, you can hardly move for the trucks.
This country and Canada as well, has definitely shifted a lot more freight from rail to trucks. And in fact, Canada, which is part of the Kyoto Protocol and is trying to meet their obligations, has noticed that the biggest single factor in their growth of CO2 emissions over the last 30 years has been shifting freight from rail to trucks. So they're trying to think about how do we go back without completely annoying the trucking industry.
That's confusing, but why would it be more efficient to take a bus than a train?
Just think about the amount of metal that you're hauling along. You know, a train car that seats about the same number of people as a bus weighs about 3 times as much. And even though there's only one engine, it's still hauling a whole lot more metal. It's not vastly more efficient, but it's somewhat more efficient on the bus.
Is that true for light rail? Cities are trying to talk about
what? Light rail is different from heavy rail, and of course a lot of it's electricity, so then it depends on where you're getting your electricity. If we ever get light rail built in Seattle, you know, it'll be running on hydro for the most part, so that's definitely a much cleaner way than taking a bus, although a lot of our buses now are either hybrid diesel electric, or they're fully electric, or, you know, we have some that are burning compressed natural gas. So, yes?
I hate to say it, because I may be, but how about nuclear? What does nuclear do to the...
Currently 85% of U.S. electricity comes from fossil sources, coal and natural gas. 9%, I think, is from nuclear, and about 4% from hydro, and then there's this tiny sliver that comes from other renewables like wind and solar. And, you know, nuclear pushes a lot of people's buttons, but I think that the magnitude of the climate change problem is such that we can't rule out any viable solution at the outset. I don't think we can rule out any approach to carbon sequestration or any approach to generating electricity. It has to be part of the discussion. That's my personal view. I know a lot of environmentalists just think that we shouldn't even go there. And this is a big debate in Europe, where, you know, they are very seriously trying to reduce their carbon emissions. And France, for example, gets something like 3/4 of its electricity from nuclear. And so, you know, expanding nuclear is part of how they're going to meet their Kyoto obligations. Britain, likewise, which, as we saw yesterday, has already reduced its emissions of CO2 considerably. It's partly because they're building more nuclear plants, as well as wind and other stuff. Yes?
If you're producing so much nuclear, where do they store their waste? That's been our big problem here.
I don't know. Are they shipping it off to Russia? No, I'm sure they have underground storage facilities. The head of our research group has a background in international policy, and he spent 10 years working for the European Union on the problem of nuclear waste disposal. And the scientists concluded that the safest thing to do was to seal it and drop it to the bottom of the ocean. But that was considered not a viable approach, so they went with some other approach, which I don't know, but I assume it's underground. Other questions, comments? Yeah.
Well, they're talking about expanding nuclear here now.
I think that would be a big move.
The biggest problem. Well, anybody here from Washington State? So you know about whoops.
Mm-hmm.
The Washington Public Power
System.
There were two S's went there, but anyway. Nuclear plants are extremely expensive to build, and that was a case where a state that had lots of hydro, which is pretty cheap, spent $1.5 billion or something like that in 1970s dollars to build a couple of nuclear plants, which ended up not getting finished, am I correct? So it was just a lot of money down the drain. That's certainly one drawback for big power plants, is that they're very expensive, whether they're nuclear or coal or whatever, but nuclear is probably the most expensive. Tomorrow when we talk about other forms of energy, and Steve Jones will do his thing on wind, he'll begin to see where some opportunities are. And particularly as we think about, you know, the developing world, it doesn't make sense to spend, you know, $500 million for a power plant and a gigantic distribution system. It may make more sense to spend an equal amount in building little combination solar, wind, maybe natural gas plants distributed around to a bunch of villages rather than this other model. So that, you know, there are a lot of new 21st century approaches to this rather than just using early 20th century energy technology. I think we've still got a little more time.
Can you think of a country that's a good example, like a trendsetter around these types of solutions?
Well, Iceland is a very interesting example, and of course it's one that is unique and can't really, I mean, they're a trendsetter in a way, but it's not like we could just jump on that bandwagon. Iceland, of course, has a vast amount of geothermal energy, unlike any other country, and a lot of hydropower. So already most of their electricity comes from, you know, fully non-fossil sources. They've recently decided to capitalize on that and do an experiment that would provide a demonstration project for the rest of the world, and that is to switch all their mobile sources to hydrogen fuel cells. The problem with hydrogen fuel cells is that you have to make the hydrogen somehow, and the hydrogen itself is not a source of energy, it's just a way of transporting energy around. With a renewable source of electricity, you can generate the hydrogen at that source, particularly in off-peak periods, and then store the hydrogen and then deliver it to the users of cars and trucks and trains and buses and so on. And then you've got the best of both worlds, because you've got a fully renewable electricity source combined with a non-fossil way of having a liquid fuel. Because the liquid fuels are really going to be the hardest nut to crack if we try to go to a low-carbon energy. Other countries besides Iceland that might be a little more applicable, I would say probably the UK, where they've, since 1990, they have reduced their greenhouse gas outputs by almost 10%, and at the same time have had and the US incidentally during that time has increased our as we'll see tomorrow, I don't remember what the exact number is, but our greenhouse gas emissions have increased something like 20%, and our economic growth rates are identical over that period. So that may not be fully applicable to the U.S. case, but it is an interesting illustrative example. Yes.
When Clinton was in office, I read something that the Kyoto Protocol, he was saying, needed some changes, or whatever. And then we know that the current administration hasn't adopted the Kyoto Protocol as is. What are some of those changes that are controversial or that maybe?
Well, all of these solutions are things that actually reduce CO2 emissions or methane emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. The Kyoto Protocol didn't specify actual reductions approaches. It just said how much reductions had to be achieved.
Okay.
And one of the big sticking points in the negotiations between the U.S. and Europe was the extent to which you could reduce your country's responsibility for emissions by simply buying emissions credits somewhere else. And the U.S. was pushing for a lot of flexibility in buying credits elsewhere. And Europe, in this sort of moral indignation, said, you have to reduce your own emissions. This is, you know, you have no business spewing all this CO2 out into the world. We don't care if you clean it up afterwards. You have to reduce it yourself. So there was some give and take on that, but in the end, there was an agreement that could have been signed by the US. Clinton never submitted it to the Senate for ratification because they had already said before the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated, that they would not accept any treaty that did not require reductions in China. The reason that was I'm getting a little bit ahead of, you know, this, we're going to talk about the U.S. tomorrow, but in the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change, what the U.S. Senate ratified said that any agreement on climate change would require what's called common but differentiated responsibilities, meaning that the developed world would take the first step. And then the developing world would come on board once the developed world had demonstrated that they were serious. So China was specifically exempted in the 1992 treaty from any emissions reductions. But under the influence of the fossil fuel lobby, the Senate in 1997, sort of forgetting the policy context, passed a resolution, 97 to nothing. So we're not talking about, you know, one party or the other, the bad guys.
Right.
97 to nothing. They said, we find that any, it was a declaration, a Senate resolution. It wasn't a bill, it was a resolution, saying that any treaty that required emissions reductions of the U.S. but not of China would not be ratified. So Clinton never submitted for ratification because he wasn't able to get around this 97 to nothing vote. And of course, it takes a two-thirds majority to pass a treaty. And, you know, so if Gore had been elected or Kerry had been elected, the story would not have changed. I mean, it's convenient to blame George Bush, but as I'll describe tomorrow, the truth is a lot more nuanced. And, you know, we can't really blame President Clinton either. This was, this issue was just not enough on the radar screen of Congress in the 90s to understand that connection between the 1992 vote and the 1997.
Well, and China has adopted the Kyoto Protocol, correct?
Oh, sure, but
yeah,
they're not subject to any emissions reductions. So, yeah, there were 170 nations that signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, 150 nations that signed on to the Kyoto Protocol. The U.S. and Australia are about the only ones that didn't. But there are only about 15 countries in the world that are actually obligated to reduce emissions.
Well, before the other ones signed.
Well, because they get to participate in what are called joint implementation projects. So let's suppose that France wants to reduce its emissions, and they figure out that it's going to be more cost effective to pay for emissions reductions in Costa Rica or Mozambique or China, then they can, you know, pay money to those countries to install, you know, a new wind farm or plant a new forest or whatever. So it's advantageous to those countries because then they're on the receiving end of these international projects. The original understanding of the Kyoto Protocol, of course, was that it would be only the first baby step in a series of steps of reductions, and that at the next stage, that's when you would start to expect emissions reductions commitments from the developing countries as well. But it's hard to see where that process is headed now, that the U.S. isn't part of it. Yes, Dora?
This may be a trivial question after this global thing, but I've heard that lawnmowers and things like this are a big source of problems.
Yeah, you know, automobiles are subject to all sorts of regulations, particularly in the U.S. and especially in California, as far as their emissions, both of pollutants and you know, their overall efficiency. And you're quite right that smaller, noisier engines like simple motorcycles, lawnmowers, snowmobiles, boats, those are not subject to anywhere near the same kind of regulations. So they're a huge local air quality problem. As well as being fairly inefficient at getting a job done. We have an electric mower because, you know, it doesn't spew anything out. Not necessarily an option for everybody, and I've never seen a riding electric lawnmower if you have a vast amount of grass to cut.
I also read in The Economist that the idea of trees serving as carbon, whatever they are, is questionable or more problematic.
Yeah, I was shocked to learn at a conference 4 years ago that even though the Northwest is a great place to grow trees, that the cost of taking a ton of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere by planting trees in the Northwest is something like 10 or 20 times the cost of taking it out in other more conventional ways. For example, replacing a coal-fired power plant with a wind farm. So there may be other countries in the world where it's a little closer to a balance, and there are actually projects along those lines of tree planting to reduce carbon, but they tend to be in tropical countries where land is cheaper.
Yeah, and I guess this article actually was saying that tree planting often reduces the amount of available water in various tropical and other places, and it uses up more water than it saves, and also, it was basically saying trees aren't necessarily going to work. Trees aren't green.
It depends on what
they were saying.
The water issue is a bit of, that could be presented in a misleading way. If you wanted the maximum amount of water flowing down this valley into Lake Chelan, you'd just cut down all the trees, because sure, they suck water out of the soil and help evaporate it. That's obviously not a good way to achieve that result if that's really what you wanted to do. And a lot of these places that are being replanted were already forested, and so in a sense, by planting trees you're reducing the water going in, but you're restoring it back to sort of the way it was before. So the economics, I think, are probably more where the sticking point is. There is actually a global market in carbon, and so a company wants to buy emissions reductions. The Chicago Climate Exchange, for example, you can go spend about $5 to reduce a ton of CO2 in the atmosphere.
With all the conversions of power plants to natural gas, when are we going to run out of natural gas?
Well, that's a good question. We have probably come near the peak of global oil production. There are a variety of indicators that suggest that if it's not already passed, it's almost certainly going to happen within 10 years. New discoveries have lagged behind consumption for a couple of decades now. Saudi Arabia can no longer ramp up to meet demand, and that's part of why gas prices are so high, is that there just isn't enough capacity to produce to meet the amount of demand. Natural gas probably has a little longer before we see a peak and then start to run into supply problems. Coal, we have easily several hundred years of supply. So if natural gas got to be too expensive for power plants and there were no environmental priorities written into law about new power plants not being coal, then we'd just build a lot of coal plants and generate new electricity that way, which of course would, that would feed into the climate change problem as well as air pollution. And that's a big issue in China especially.
So how does a coal gasification plant operate?
I'm not too familiar with those. I have read a little bit, and I guess the idea is that you essentially you try to convert the coal into a natural gas kind of thing first, and then it burns much more cleanly. But I don't know. Anybody else know about coal gasification? Steve Jones might, but if you come tomorrow, we can ask him. Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you.